Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear arguments from petitioner in National Liability and Fire versus Allen.
May it please the court, Mr. Bob Kane and Mr. Harry Deckard will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Kane will open for the first 10 minutes and will also present the rebuttal.
This is an evidence case. We're asking the court to construe an evidence statute. I think it's important to put the case in its broader context. This is an administrative appeal, and we're asking the court to construe a statute that, in its broadest terms, regulates an administrative appeal. It gets into the nature of the evidence that the trial court may consider on that appeal. The court is held before that, of course, the standard is a modified trial de novo. It's not a substantial evidence of the case where the court would be limited to the agency record itself, nor is it a pure trial de novo where everything gets tossed out that the administrative agency did and the parties court start over. The court has to decide the same issues that the administrative agency decided, and usually it's going to have to consider the same evidence. In some cases, in an impairment rating case, the court is going to be limited to hearing, strictly speaking, the exact evidence that the commission considered, with a few exceptions. And in
all cases, ask you about that. In impairment rating cases, does that mean you can't bring the record in, just have the record of the commission verbatim on the impairment ratings, or do you have to bring the physicians and testify about the impairment ratings?
I have seen it done where the commission record is simply submitted. The doctor's reports are offered, and that's it. I'm sure that the doctors occasionally, they do appear, but most of the ones I've seen, not that many, their record is used. There's not been any objection by either side to doing that. Medical records are introduced in regular civil trials, too.
The district court review, or the trial court review, is not really a substantial evidence deal. It's just some sort of combination of things.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if that's the case, is the trial court responsible for evaluating the credibility of the witnesses and the weight to be given their testimony?
I believe the answer to that, Your Honor, is generally speaking, yes. The statute says that the trial should be conducted by preponderance of the evidence standard. Presumably, in most issues at least, the judge or jury in the district court would have the opportunity to weigh the evidence as it saw fit.
And so there might be a rational basis for evaluating the rules such that previous the testimony in the administrative hearing would not be admissible in the trial of the case absent a showing that the witness was unavailable. I mean, there'd be a basis for reading it that way.
Well, the court certainly can read it that way. I think the presumption ought to be the opposite, that evidence for the commission, it might be easier for the commission, evidence that was presented for the commission to be submitted to the trial court, same as a deposition testimony could be in a regular civil case.
If that's the case, then how do you reconcile the provisions of the statute that indicate that conformity to the legal rules of evidence is not required in the proceedings of the commission, and yet conformity to the rules of evidence is required in a judicial review or trial of the matter?
Well, I think there's the way to handle that is pretty simple, really. In this case, we have witness testimony, Tom Angers. He testified for the commission contested case hearing.
And he testified in another proceeding.
Yes.
All right, and what do the rules of evidence, if the rules of evidence apply, then what do the rules of evidence require for you to be able to submit that testimony in a trial, in a court?
If my reading of Section 410.306 is not correct, then we would have to prove that he was unavailable with all the requirements that are on that.
Because that's what the rules of evidence require.
That's what the rule of evidence itself says.
Then how do you read 306 to avoid that requirement?
Well, as if you treat Mr. Anger's testimony for the commission as if it were, in essence, deposition testimony. If he starts going off what is hearsay, he starts quoting some third person about what they said, and the commission lets it in for whatever reason, the trial judge is going to be able to exclude that as hearsay, as if Mr. Angers himself, it's exactly as if he was sitting there in the jury, in front of the jury. He can't testify as to hearsay in the civil trial court. He might be able to the administrative case, but to the extent his testimony at the commission would have been admissible in a civil case, it would be admissible at the trial.
I'm sorry, if it was admissible at the commission?
If his testimony comported with the rules of civil evidence as it was presented at the commission, then that testimony would be permitted at the trial court.
But how are we able to determine that in a proceeding in which the rules of evidence do not apply, where there would be no obligation on the part of any party to lay proper foundations to testimony, for anyone to make any objections, and for anyone to rule on them? We would have to, after the fact then, in the trial, ask the trial judge to look back in the absence of a complete record and say whether or not something would have been admissible before the commission.
Well,
how do we get around that problem?
Same way it happens in virtually every civil case. A deposition can be taken. The lawyer may not ask the proper questions to lay the predicate for the witness's testimony. It's offered at trial, and the trial court can exclude it.
But objections are made at that point. You're required to object in the deposition. Isn't the whole purpose of the commission proceeding, not having the rules apply, to allow it to be a quick, easy administrative hearing that's not constrained by the rules of evidence as you are in a deposition?
Well, I think many objections are, in fact, reserved for time of trial and questions as to form, I think. Those sorts of objections have to, I don't know that you have to object to a predicate being laid. Some objections have to be made at deposition, but not all.
Well, but you're making the analogy to a deposition. I mean, you can still make those objections at trial. Here you say you can't.
I would say you can make those objections at trial. If the evidence, the testimony for the commission doesn't meet whatever rule, if it's double hearsay, irrelevant, the trial court can exclude it.
Okay, so anything, if a document's put into evidence at the commission and a proper predicate's not laid to it, then that document does not automatically go into evidence in the trial, and in fact, an objection could be made, and the trial court would have to rule on whether or not that document is in evidence in the trial.
If the evidence is not tendered showing its proper predicate, that's correct.
Okay, so then you don't disagree with the Court of Appeals' decision in this case that the evidence that comes in at the trial that follows the administrative proceeding must comport in each instance with the rules of evidence. Proper foundations have to be laid to admit documents. Hearsay is not admitted, and so on and so forth. You agree with the Court of Appeals to that extent, and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals and its comparable decision.
I would agree. If I understand the court's question, yes, I agree. And what I'm not going to agree is that you have to, before you can even offer it, you've got to get past a hearsay, an initial hearsay objection, that anything before the commission is automatically hearsay. You've got to get past that hearsay rule first.
This is with respect to testimony.
With respect to testimony.
So you think that, in other words, what your quarrel with, if I understand correctly, then your quarrel with the Court of Appeals decision is, in this instance, is that the testimony from the commission should have been treated as testimony in the same proceeding as a deposition would be, so that the requirement associated with testimony from a different proceeding would not apply.
Yes, Your Honor. That's That's going to be my...
So it's not, your quarrel is not with the application of the rules of evidence, but the manner in which the court in this instance applied them.
And it's also important to remember, I think, that in a sense, this is the same proceeding. It's a different level of the same case. The same issues are supposed to be decided. I think the court ought to make it, of course, ought to make it easier to present that same evidence, again, hoping to minimize the time, expense, delay of trial of these cases.
But it just puts the burden on the opponent to bring the witness in and try to either change the testimony or attack the credibility or whatever. It might make it easier, it might make it harder. It just might make it harder on the other side.
That depends on your point of view, I guess, Your Honor. But that's going to be the case in any event. There's a critical piece of evidence out there. I don't necessarily... There's not a lot to be gained by sending a couple of lawyers all the way across the country to get some witness to testify in an ordinary comp case. That doesn't seem that a very effective use of resources.
Was the trial court ever apprised in this case of your position that this, in fact, was testimony from the same proceeding and therefore didn't have to be treated under the rules of evidence associated with testimony from a different proceeding?
Did you ever
apprise the trial court of that?
I don't believe that the statute was cited. The trial court was aware of the nature of the testimony, that it was, in fact, from the...
I understand, but was the trial court ever told that your basis for trying to admit it was that it was testimony from the same proceeding, so that under the rules of evidence it should have been used just like a deposition was and was not subject to the unavailability requirement of testimony from a different proceeding?
I do not believe that was said to the trial court, Your Honor.
Was it raised in the court of appeal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Allen says, even if you're right that it was improperly excluded, it's harmless because it's cumulative of Exhibit 8, which was admitted and in the record, which contained Mr. Anger's testimony almost verbatim.
Well, I would disagree that it was almost verbatim. It was a short one-paragraph summary, as much a commentary as it was a summary.
What was missing from the summary that was critical to the testimony that you wanted the jury to hear?
I believe that I cannot point to a specific statement that was missing, but it's as much of a gloss on his testimony as it was just a restatement or summary. That also gets to another issue, though, in the broader question. If the commission decision is going to be admitted, the commission decision routinely recites all the testimony. If that argument of cumulativeness is any good at all, then certainly the court ought to let the jury hear the direct evidence that the administrative law judge, hearings officer heard, not just the appeals panel's recitation of it at a later date. I need to yield my time to Mr. Deckard.
Let me just ask you real quickly, doesn't that indicate that the legislature knew how to write the statute and they clearly did not provide for that? They clearly said that facts and evidence are admissible to the extent allowed under the rules of civil evidence.
Well, I think that's sort of the converse of what Mr. Francis pointed out, that there's a difference. Rules of evidence do not have to be complied with the administrative agency itself. But, of course, once the legislation would say that evidence can come in, but it's got to meet the standards that it would have to meet if it were originally offered at the trial court. That is, under the rules of evidence, it's stopped by this court.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. My name is Harry Deckard. I work for the Attorney General's Office, and I represent the Workers' Compensation Commission when we filed an intervention in this case. I have a few comments to add in connection with this evidentiary issue. And really, our position is somewhat different. A lot of questions were raised concerning the admissibility of the commission record. Our position is that the court should support a position that makes the record easily admissible in these trials, because once again, this is a limited trial, a modified trial de novo, but the focus should be, or that the trier of fact should be given as much information relating to what happened before the commission in order to determine if the commission's decision should be upheld. And our concern is that the focus of the Court of Appeals in this case is on Rule 804, whether or not the declarant was unavailable, whether or not the carrier met the criteria for getting the record in that way, when really the focus should have been on whether it was admissible under Rule 803 as a governmental record. I think that's what the legislature was looking at. But if a party wants to get the commission record in, they should get it in under Rule 803, paragraph 8.
So 803 applies to everything that occurs in the commission proceeding, and once it's authenticated under 803, everything comes in and no other objections can be made and no other determinations need to be made on admissibility?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that there's a presumption of admissibility under Rule 803, and again, the courts, my research shows that once again, 803 is patterned after the federal rule, 803, and the cases in the federal system support admissibility. And the test for admissibility in those cases is whether or not the information, the documents, the statements are trustworthy or not.
Well, what if there's hearsay in the deposition?
Well, once again,
if it's just testimony.
Yeah, if the statement itself is simply a hearsay statement, then we, under Rule 803, it should come in. But the question becomes, when you examine the statement, is there hearsay within hearsay? Is it prejudicial?
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes.
If there's a question in that testimony that calls for hearsay,
yes,
and it would be properly excluded under the Texas Rules of Evidence, under your proposed rule that 803 governs everything, how is that to be handled?
Well, I think that once the document is offered under Rule 803, then there has to be an examination made of the statement or the document itself and determine if there, once again, if a proper objection has been made.
Well, there wouldn't have been a proper objection, though, because there's no objection required in the proceedings before the commission.
Well, I'm saying at the trial court level. In other words, if an objection was made at the trial court level relating to admissibility of the evidence on whatever basis, then at that point in time, the trial court should properly evaluate whether or not it's admissible.
If I understand what you're saying, under 803 in your interpretation, you just get the record marked and say, we offered under 803, and it's in. And then, if I understand what you're saying, the other side has to go through it and start making objections to the parts they think would be excluded for some reason under the rules of evidence, which now apply in the trial court, which seems to me to be a situation of a long gone out procedure under those circumstances in the trial of the case, which doesn't promote efficiency in getting the case over.
Well,
or do you do it as we see in the ISIS case and here, a part's offered and the other side has the opportunity to make whatever objections they think are good and let the trial court rule on without having to do everything?
Yes, sir, I understand. I certainly would not condone wholesale admission of the commission record and then say we'd like to tender this and then have the record.
But on the other hand, in the substantial evidence case, that's exactly right.
Yeah, there's a difference.
And so the legislature obviously knew.
Yes.
When they said we're not going to do substantial evidence in these kind of cases, we're going to have a preponderance of evidence, and we're
correct,
going to require that the evidence at the trial level be subject to the Texas Rules of Evidence.
My view
is a clear, plain meaning of and reading of the scheme that we have here.
Well, I see the court's concern. Hopefully, what should happen is that the parties will be able to, in order to promote an orderly trial, get together, go through the commission record, and make these decisions beforehand. Or the proffering party should come in and pick out the documents that they believe are necessary to support their position in the case, and then...
But this is not a document in this case. This is a recording of a particular witness's testimony.
Well, it's a transcription of testimony that occurred.
It only becomes a document because it's transcribed.
Yes.
We understand that.
That's correct. But, again, that is a document. Once it becomes transcribed, and my view is, and the commission's view is, if you have transcribed testimony or other statements that were admitted at the contested case hearing, and you can overcome, that is, and if it meets the other evidentiary test, then it should clearly be admissible. I think
so. I'm having a hard time,
yes,
understanding your argument. And I don't understand the overlay of 803 applying to everything. If what really has to happen is the Texas Rules of Evidence apply, so with respect to the pieces of the record, the appropriate foundations or prerequisites have to be laid to admit the pieces, because appropriate objections would be made under rules specific to the type of evidence offered.
Yes.
Well, what's the purpose of the 803 overlay then?
I suppose I have two responses. The first response is I'd like to ask leave of the court to brief this issue, because again our original focus was the Sinclair issue. My second response is my reading of the cases, and again there is a Texas case that interprets the way that the federal view. The courts tend to favor admissibility of these types of records, even though it contains the defects that we've been talking about. Again, the test, and most of the, let me digress a little bit. The federal case involved a plane crash, and the issue is whether or not the investigation of the crash came in. And the investigation report contained all kinds of problems under the rules of evidence. The Supreme Court of the United States said it still comes in. The Texas case I'm thinking about involved a similar situation. It was a helicopter crash. The parties wanted to get an Army report in relating to the helicopter crash. Once again, the Army's report contained all kinds of hearsay problems, conclusions, opinions. The Court of Appeals in Amarillo said it comes in based on the same arguments that were raised in the federal case. Most of the other cases in Texas have to do with driver's license revocation hearings. Those are civil proceedings. And in most of those cases, they involve situations where a policeman comes and observes the drunk driver, makes all kinds of opinions and statements in the report. Every case, that record comes in. And that's really, I think, a similar situation, or at least in most cases.
I have a question about,
yes,
the judicial notice issue that was raised by your co-petitioner.
Yes.
As I understand the record, the commission was the one that offered this document into the Court of Appeals under judicial notice. Is that
That's
right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I can't tell right away. Was your co-petitioner with you on that at the time? You know, did they object to it?
Well, I the best response would be to ask him. I think he was, because at that point in time, our concern was whether or not
I understand what your concern was, because you thought you had a document that showed it was too late.
Yes.
But it was looked at for a different purpose. So are you stuck with what you offered and required the court to, or wanted them to put into the record, whether it turned out good or bad?
Well, I'd be hard-pressed to argue that the document's not accurate. So we are stuck.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the response.
May it please the court, Mr. Darren Walker, present argument to the response.
May it please the court, Mr. Allen's arguments regarding the evidentiary issue are based primarily on the well-recognized rule that when construing a statute, the court will assume that the legislature said what it meant and meant what it said and apply the plain language of the statute. The plain language of the statute says that the facts and evidence that are contained within the TWCC records are admissible at trial to the extent allowed by the Texas Rules of Evidence. Because the statute plainly said that, when Mr. Anger's prior testimony at the administrative hearing was offered, Mr. Allen objected that because it was not a deposition, but was instead former testimony, that the proponent had the burden to prove that the witness was unavailable under Rule 804.
It doesn't say the transcript, though, does it? It says the facts and evidence.
That's a very good point, Your Honor, and frankly, that is not one that I had raised previously, but Mr. Allen has never taken the position, I have to honestly confess, that this was not part of the record that is subject to Rule 410.306B in the Labor Code, but that's an excellent point. Whether a transcript is even considered part of the facts and evidence is, I suppose, a question that must be addressed before we even get to the issue of whether 410.306B would mandate the admissibility of this type of evidence. And that's really what the dispute boils down to, because there's no real dispute between National Liability and Mr. Allen that if we apply the rules of evidence to the trial court proceeding, this was clearly hearsay because the proponent, National Liability, did not prove the declarant's unavailability at trial.
Is it equally clear that if the rules had applied at the commission proceeding, this would have been admissible under the rules of evidence?
In other words,
would
the hearing officer have admitted it? I believe it is. I searched through the Bill of Exception to try to find some objectionable portion so that I could argue, well, it was objectionable on this basis, and I couldn't. So if the rules of evidence had been applied before the commission, then the commission officer would have admitted it. It would have been admissible testimony because Mr. Andrews was there, and he testified live. They weren't trying to put in some statement that he had made elsewhere. Allen's position is, though, that Rule 410.306B does not make everything that came in before the commission automatically admissible in the trial court. We believe that Rule 410.306B is a rule designed to ensure that the rules of evidence are applied to evidence that's contained in the commission record. In other words, the commission record evidence is not automatically admissible just because it's in the commission record, but neither is it automatically inadmissible just because it was part of this administrative process. There's been in the briefing, Mr. Kane offers his theory of why the legislature included the clause to the extent allowed by the Texas Rules of Evidence in the statute.
Well, again, let me go back. It doesn't say the record is admissible to the extent allowed in the Texas Rules of Evidence. It says the facts and evidence the record contains are admissible. So if there are facts in the record, why aren't they admissible if they're admissible under the Texas Rules of Evidence?
Well, I certainly believe that under the plain language of the statute, any facts contained in the record that are admissible at trial under the Texas Rules of Evidence would be admissible at trial. Well, let's suppose that National Liability had brought evidence before the trial court that Mr. Andrews, from the time of the TWCC hearing until today, had been out of the state, not subject to subpoena, that they had made reasonable efforts to depose him and were unable to do so, and therefore he was unavailable. At that point, his testimony before the TWCC would have been admissible. They just didn't comply with that. Or let's suppose that there was a letter that Mr. Allen had written to, you know, a friend, and he had said, guess what, I'm really going to put one over on the company. I didn't really suffer an injury. And then that were contained within the commission record. Well, that would be admissible because it was an admission of a party opponent. Those are the types, you know, any fact or evidence that was there that is admissible under the rules of evidence would be admissible. Our only contention is that the Court of Appeals did not err, and neither did the trial court, because this particular evidence or testimony that was offered at trial was inadmissible under the rules of evidence.
What about testifying physicians who testify about impairment ratings? Can you just tender into the trial court record their testimony before the commission, or do you have to bring the doctor back alive?
Your Honor, I have to confess that I'm not as familiar with the different standard of review that applies to impairment ratings. I understand that, that it is different from the standard of review that applies
what's
to...
What's that got to do with what's admissible in the trial court?
Well, because I believe that Section 410.306B is, which is the rule that talks about the admissibility of facts and evidence before the commission, is in the section of the statute that applies to this modified de novo review of issues of compensability and eligibility for benefits. Now, I don't want to say that absolutely because I'm not 100% sure of that. If, assuming though, that the standard of review doesn't impact this, that 410.306B would apply in any type of proceeding, then Mr. Allen's argument has to be that if that evidence is hearsay, which I think it would be, that you would have to bring the testifying physician before the court, or perhaps Mr. Decker's argument that it is a record contained in a public document or something might be another method of getting it admissible under the rules of evidence. But I don't believe that when the legislature said that that evidence is admissible to the extent allowed by the Texas Rules of Evidence, I don't think that, that we should look past that plain language of that statute in order to facilitate an easier trial of the case.
But in your view, though, facts and evidence in any record are admissible in a proceeding and to the extent allowed by the Texas Rules of Evidence.
Well, that's true.
The facts and evidence in an Afghanistan record are admissible.
That's absolutely
on whatever, as you apply the Texas Rules of Evidence.
That's absolutely right.
So this statement, all this statement says is that nothing that happens before the commission is admissible in the subsequent trial just because it happened before the commission. That's your view.
I think that it says that, and I think that it says the converse. Nothing that happens is inadmissible in a subsequent trial just because it happened before the commission. And I've talked about this briefly in my brief. There are some old cases that talk about the IAB award being inadmissible in a trial, a de novo. And I know that at least one trial lawyer I'm aware of has always used those cases to argue that anything that happened before the IAB should be inadmissible because this is a trial de novo and what they did doesn't matter and the jury is supposed to determine it on their own. Whether that argument was right or wrong, I think it's logical to believe that the legislature may have been trying to foreclose that argument in new law cases. We don't have pure de novo review anymore, and you know the jury is entitled to know what the TWCC thought, so we don't have any more an argument that, well, anything that happened before the TWCC should be inadmissible because this is a de novo trial.
May I ask you a question about that? It seems from the way the statute's written that the trial court's required to, in the charge by instruction or question or whatever, to tell the jury what the commission did. And that each one of those issues that were contested in the district court trial, they have to do that. Do you actually introduce the opinion and the judgment itself into the record and send it to the jury room to satisfy that requirement, or does it just go by an instruction and a charge?
Well, I think certainly the ISIS case said that it's permissible to admit the opinion. I don't know that admitting the opinion into evidence would satisfy that requirement because I believe that the requirement is that the court is to apprise the jury in the charge of what the... So I don't think that just admitting it into evidence but saying nothing about it in the charge would satisfy the requirement.
Well, but one of your arguments in this particular case is that Exhibit 8 is exactly what that is, and I assume that it went to the jury.
It did.
Based on your argument.
It did.
That therefore, this evidence that they're saying was improperly admitted, was excluded, was already there, so it's cumulative and a harmless error.
That's correct, Your Honor. Not because the court informed the jury in the charge of what the TWCC had done, but because it actually admitted a copy, and it didn't recite question and answer, question and answer. What it did was a summary, a one-paragraph summary, but The important part of the bill of exception was Mr. Andrews said, I remember we had a conversation. I don't remember Mr. Allen ever telling me that he had a work-related injury, and I think I would have remembered that if he had said that. That's the important part of the bill of exception, and that's all stated in the appeals panel's decision. Now, Mr. Kane raises a good point. Well, yes, but the appeals panel indicated that that wasn't very credible or didn't contradict what Mr. Allen said because Mr. Andrews repeatedly said, I can't remember what happened over a year ago. But just as you pointed out, in these new modified de novo reviews, the jury is supposed to know what the appeals panel's interpretation of the evidence was. So while that may have been a good argument in an old law case where the jury's not supposed to be influenced by what the IAB did, in a new law case, you know, the jury is supposed to at least understand what the TWCC's interpretation.
Well, couldn't the trial court satisfy the statutory requirement in this case by saying, I instruct you that the appeals panel found that Mr. Allen did not give timely notice that this was work-related, and that's all they have to say. And then there, the jury can take that and say, well, we think different because of what we've heard here.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't you want to show that the reason the IAB found as it did was because of this testimony, or this fact? I mean, if the IAB had found that the claimant had not given notice, and that was based on testimony that was rather obviously in the record incredible, wouldn't you want to put that on in the trial court? Say this is what they were relying on.
Make sure I understand your question. Assuming I represent Mr. Allen, and what I want to say, here was the testimony that the IAB heard. You haven't heard that testimony. That's why your decision is going to be different from
yes.
that. Okay. Well, yes, that would be.
But you couldn't do it.
Probably not, because Champion, the employee who testified that way, was a Champion International employee, not a National Liability Insurance Company employee. So it's not a statement of a party opponent. So yes, I believe I probably would have been precluded from. Now
you
I could
have put the parties at a disadvantage because the jury's going to be sitting there listening to an argument, I dare say, from somebody that says you should do what the commission did. I mean, these are reasonable people; they're paid to make these decisions all the time. And if you don't know why they did it differently, that's a pretty compelling argument.
Yes, it is, Judge, and I would think that if that were something that the advocates foresaw, as we should, as you have, we would go to whatever lengths we needed to go to in order to present that testimony in admissible form. Every time we have a trial, there's something that we want to tell the jury, and we think, well, you know, is it going to be admissible? What do we need to do to get it admissible? Do I need to take this fellow's deposition, or can I rely on this affidavit that we have? And we go to the books and we figure out whether it's admissible or not. And I think that the legislature, when it adopted this rule that said facts and evidence contained in the commission record are admissible to the extent allowed by the Texas Rules of Evidence, was telling advocates, make sure that your evidence is in admissible form. It's not going to be admissible just because it's contained in the record.
Your opponent said that we should treat this testimony more like a deposition that could be used regardless of the unavailability of the witness. Would you respond to that argument, please?
Yes, and Your Honor, I have to fall back on the plain language. The rules of court differentiate between depositions and former testimony. This is not a deposition. It's former testimony. I think that to say, well, we should treat it like a deposition, even though it isn't, because that way we could get the evidence in, it flies in the face of the plain language of the rules. My response is, this is not a deposition, and it should be treated for what it is, not what they would like it to be.
Is there any way way you can reasonably interpret this in that way in order to facilitate the fact that this is really a continuation of the same proceeding and given the modified trial de novo atmosphere. I hear your opponent saying that's a reasonable way to apply the rule because of the unique nature of this being a judicial review and administrative proceeding. And so, as I think the Attorney General's office has said, it should be a little bit easier to admit.
Well, Your Honor, my response to that argument would be that the legislature is the one that has set up the system. They decided what rules would apply and what rules wouldn't, they did not see fit to include any rule that says the transcription of oral testimony before the hearing panel will be considered a deposition. They didn't include a rule that says it is admissible regardless of the rules of hearsay. They didn't take any efforts whatsoever to facilitate that. It may be a better rule. It may make things easier on everyone, but I would respectfully suggest that that's something for the legislature to correct.
A question, a different scenario, just that Mr. Anger's deposition was taken before the panel had its hearing, and that was offered into evidence. Then, of course, no objections made. And here they come for the trial before the district court, and they offer the deposition, not the record. Where are we?
And Your Honor, I'm embarrassed you're giving me a test on evidence law. I can't recall. I believe that if it were a deposition that were taken, and I think this would be considered the same proceeding, because our argument's not based on whether it's the same or different proceeding. Our argument's based on the fact that it's not a deposition. But if it were a deposition that were admissible under the rules of evidence, then it would be fine.
It's been a long time since I was in a deposition. Do you still say something like, to be used in any trial proceeding involving this controversy or whatever, so that you, it's not just the first time you ever try it, but any trial?
I think that the rules provide that for a way for a deposition to be used in multiple proceedings, although quite honestly, in all candor, I can't tell you chapter and verse exactly what the rules say about that.
So the specific application here is the difference between the deposition and how the rules of evidence treat that, and the fact that this is testimony from a former proceeding, even though they argue it's the same proceeding.
That's right. I mean, the distinction is that this is not a deposition, and that's always been Mr. Allen's position. And it's testimony from a former proceeding. Whether it would be more efficient or fair to treat it as a deposition, again, we would respectfully suggest that that's something the legislature could have done and chose not to.
Why? Can you suggest a reason why?
Why they would have elected not to do that?
Yeah, why should it be harder rather than easier to get the commission record before the court?
Well,
looks like that helps claimants for one thing. But
well, as a practical matter, let's look at what happened in this case. Mr. Allen did not have a lawyer before the commission. The administrative proceedings are set up to sort of be a quick, less formalistic thing. So Mr. Andrews testified. Mr. Allen, in his own way, he's a pipe fitter. He actually did a pretty good job of cross-examining Mr. Andrews, but he didn't have a lawyer there. They could have called Mr. Andrews to testify, but then a trial lawyer would have been cross-examining him. So instead, they try to use his testimony when he was cross-examined by Mr. Allen and introduce it instead. I think the very reasons that we have hearsay rules and so forth, and what one of the justices pointed out earlier, that in this type of a proceeding, the jury is going to determine the credibility and the demeanor of the witnesses. And so I think that maybe the legislature was thinking, look, we shouldn't let somebody testify at the commission when the claimant doesn't have a lawyer. And then, rather than calling live so that he gets cross-examined by a lawyer, we'll use his commission testimony.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
please the court. I'll just take a minute. I was asked, first part of the argument, if I could point to part of the testimony of Mr. Andrews that was not discussed in the commission's recapitulation of his testimony. I would refer the court to what's on page 264 of the reporter's record. It's attached to our brief under tab 5. Mr. Andrews is talking about a letter from Mr. Allen's doctor. He says, Don brought this letter in, and he handed it to me, and I looked at it and read it. And at that time, he told me that Dr. Moyel had told him that his injury was from this letter, you know, and that's the first time I was aware of it, and I immediately informed my supervisor. I don't think that's reflected in the commission's summary. It's pretty direct testimony that he got this letter. That was the first time he knew that Donald Allen was claiming that his injury was work-related.
Mr. Payne, let me ask a question. Do you attend a lot of these commission hearings?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. You really don't know what goes on in commission hearings? Or?
Not firsthand. Some of my partners do quite frequently. But okay.
Never mind.
It's probably wise not to ask me along that line.
I didn't.
I would also like to point the court to paragraph A of the section we've been talking about, paragraph A of section 410.306. I've not discussed that, but it says evidence shall be adduced as in other civil trials. I think if the sole purpose of the statute we're talking about was to make the rules of evidence apply, the legislature had already done that in the previous paragraph. It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot to be added. That was the sole purpose. I think that it's best looked at as a limiting of what the commission, what part of the commission records can come in. It's got to comply. Once you get past the initial hearsay aspect of the commission record itself, that the substance of it has to comply with the rules of evidence.
Anything else?
Thank you. Thank you.
Close the second argument. We'll take another brief recess.